Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 253. Today's guest is Amy Klein, an infertility survivor, a journalist, and author of The Trying Game. We will be discussing her career as a journalist, advice from her book, and life after infertility. You can find Amy and The Trying Game online at www.thetryinggamebook.com. And as always, don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus253. Take a listen. Hi, Amy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Your whole story is actually back in episode 184, but why don't you catch people up and give us the brief version of your journey to parenthood?
Great. Okay. Well, my journey didn't start like a lot of people's. I got pregnant at 41 right after I got married, and then I lost that pregnancy. And then I got pregnant again right after my honeymoon, and I lost that pregnancy. And then I started the regular path that everyone's on. I did IUIs. I moved over to IVFs. I had one IVF pregnancy that ended in miscarriage, and then I had a donor egg pregnancy that ended in miscarriage. And then I found a reproductive immunologist, which I can talk about later, who just helped my body tolerate a pregnancy. So after 4 years, 10 doctors, 3 countries, 4 miscarriages, and I guess 2 rabbis and 2 different donors, I finally had my daughter 4 years ago.
That is definitely quite the journey. And I do encourage listeners to go back to episode 184 and listen to the whole thing. But let's move into today's topic. We're going to start by talking about your journalism career, and then we'll talk about your book. What made you decide to write about your journey in 2013, especially when no one was talking about this sort of thing back then?
As a writer, it was just crazy. I walked into this dingy clinic, and I mean, the details were too good not to write about. Forget that it was my own story, but you know, you walk into this clinic and everybody is waiting online in New York. I don't know how it is in other places, but some of these women, very important businesswomen and lawyers, are waiting in line since 6 in the morning because they have to get to work, and you're paying like $10,000, but there are these old magazines, old subscriptions, and your husband has to go to something called a collection room where he gets to watch porn. And the whole thing was something out of the Twilight Zone. It seemed surreal, and it seemed like nobody was writing about it. There were people that were talking about it in these very furtive groups because it was a little bit before Facebook had these groups that people were talking about it. Because it might have been even, you know, 2012. So you could find these boards where people were talking about magic baby dust and all these acronyms and initials. But in the mainstream media, you know, women's magazines, nobody was talking about it. And I just found it so incredible as a writer. And I've been someone who writes about a lot of things that I do. I had a dating column writing about my dating life. I went skydiving, so I wrote about that. I always think of myself as a guide, you know, as a writer and a journalist, but also as a guide to things that other people don't know. I wrote about internet dating when it was just a weird thing where people thought you could get killed by meeting a stranger online. And I wrote a whole essay about it. And now today, you know, that's the only way that most people meet. People would think it's weird if a friend set you up. So I started writing about it, and just because I thought there should be something like a cosmopolitan of infertility, like people just talking to women in straight language, like, how did you not know that this world, this whole underworld exists?
Here's a big question for you that I have always wanted to ask you. How did you get a column in the New York Times?
I must have been crazy or on a lot of hormones, but I just kept writing essays to the motherlode and sending them in. I sent in a few too many because the editor just called me and said, do you want to write a column about IVF for us? And I'd written for the Times before. I'd had a few Modern Loves. I think I just kept bombarding them with essays, and I never said, I never had the idea, oh, let me write a column about this. But I just couldn't believe that nobody had written about it. So I sent them in a few essays, and then she called me. And the funny thing is, was that she said, oh, why don't you write about your IVF? I mean, it's not funny. It's kind of sad. Ha ha, funny. But she said, why don't you write about your IVF journey? And then, you know, you'll get pregnant. And about in 6 months, we'll turn that into a pregnancy column. Because, of course, she, like I, thought, okay, we're going to IVF and this is going to work right away. And we'll just turn it into a pregnancy column. But it took me 30 columns and 3 more years of this before I had to announce my pregnancy. So we were both a little naive.
How did it feel to be writing about IVF, especially while going through all of your miscarriages? And I'm curious, what about the people commenting on all the choices you were making?
The commenters were very voracious. They were very enthusiastic, and some were not so kind. So on the one hand, I was glad to have an outlet for everything that I was going through, and I was glad to chronicle it, and I was happy to use my writerly observation skills and not just to be obsessing about IVF, but just to be able to write down and impart the emotions of the journey. But on the other hand, it was tough sometimes because I was supposed to read the comments and maybe even comment on them because they were trying to build community. And it was rough as I was hopped up on hormones, going through disappointments, to read some things that people said. You know, some of the articles got 200, some of them got 500 comments. 85% of the comments were positive, you know, go, we're rooting for you. And then I got tons of emails from people who were saying, oh, I'm going through the same thing. I'm so happy. But, you know, it was probably like the 5 to 10% of people didn't understand or thought I was spoiled or wealthy. And I'm definitely not wealthy. So, you know, or privileged. I had help to get the IVF. So I was privileged enough to get some help. But it was hard to read those things. And it was hard while I was on hormones and, you know, while I was having miscarriages. But I think that, you know, a lot of the great letters, there were a lot of people who were really rooting for me and who were so happy for me that I had a baby and when I got pregnant, that made it worth it.
I know the very first review I got of this podcast was something along the lines of, why don't you just adopt? There are lots of children out there who need to be adopted. Why are you so obsessed about your own genetics? Did you just skip over those comments, the negative ones, or did you read all of them?
So at a certain point, I just made my husband read it because I couldn't. So maybe I'm not so strong. I couldn't read a lot of the comments and I had him read it and I had him read through. And some of the time, this is how he would read the comments to me. He would just be sarcastic and he would say, okay, me, 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 my story. This is all about me. Okay, I'm going to tell you what I think about you. Meaning it was never really about me, but it was about what they were going through. There was an interesting person who wrote, actually not even a comment. She wrote a whole article about me saying, should we be sympathetic to a 42-year-old woman trying to get pregnant? And she wrote it on Babbel. It was so ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't even a comment. She actually put it out there. And then her story was, if you read the whole thing, it went down to, oh, I got married young because I was worried about having kids and I got divorced. So it's not fair that Amy got to, basically, she didn't say it in these words, but basically, oh, well, this woman waited to meet the love of her life. And so is it fair? Is it fair because I did it this way? So it was basically about her. You and I both know that infertility is not only for someone who's older or who waited, or plenty of people are young, plenty of people didn't wait and they still have infertility. So the answer, of course, is should we be sympathetic is yes. But you hear that a lot about people, oh, they're waiting or they're focusing on their career. Most women that I know are not focusing on their career, even if they're older when they meet someone. It's just because they haven't met someone yet. In terms of the why don't you adopt, there were plenty of that. And I actually wrote a whole column about why don't you adopt in the New York Times. And in my book, I have a 3-part answer to why don't you adopt because there are so many babies out in the world. And number one, there are not so many babies out in the world or kids out in the world to adopt. It's very hard to adopt and it's costly and it's starting a new process. Number two, if I should adopt because I have fertility issues, then you should adopt too. It's not, if there were babies needing adoption, it's everybody's responsibility to adopt. And number three is, you know, plenty of people want their own genetic kids, and I'm allowed to want my own genetic kids too. So that's my three-part answer to why don't you adopt?
I love your point about age. I was lucky enough to meet my husband at 18. We obviously didn't get married when I was 18, but right. We got married when I was 21. And for us, it was kind of waiting for a while. He didn't want to start trying until I was 27. But that's when my infertility journey started. When I was 27, I did my first IVF cycle when I was 28. So obviously, infertility does not just impact people who are older. And that's a really important point to make. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh, and one more thing about the adoption is that people adopt for many reasons. And I'm not criticizing anyone who adopts. I think it's a great thing. If you want to adopt, you can adopt. But a lot of people who adopted, they adopt after an infertility diagnosis. Now, whether that means they adopted after trying infertility treatment or just after a diagnosis, if adoption is your path, that's wonderful, but I don't know if we should saint people who do adoption over infertility. Everyone has their own unique path to childhood, you know, to being parents.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I want to talk about your book. Why did you decide to write a book about all of this, especially when there now is so much information available on the internet?
You know, it's funny. When I was writing this, and I guess it keeps me sane, but I always think, oh, what's the story? What's the story here? So when I was going through all this, I thought, okay, you know, I had more than 30 columns in the Times, plus I wrote for the Washington Post and Slate and Salon about infertility. And I thought, okay, this will be my book. I'll write a book about my own journey and having a baby. And I did write that book, and I wrote down all the details of everything that I went through. But I sent it out to a couple of agents, and one agent said, I want more infertility. And another agent is like, I want less infertility. I want more about your life. And it just hit me one day that I was answering all these questions, you know, either online or people still writing to me. And it was this, a lot of the same questions over and over again. How do I find a doctor? I hate my best friend because she's making me throw her a baby shower. The questions ran pretty similar, either medical questions or emotional questions. I realized that the book was, my story is interesting, but it's not that helpful. And if I'm answering questions online every single day, then maybe I should write a book that's, you know, helping other people. The interesting thing is, between the time I started and then kind of had a baby and woke up at a baby fog, there was so much information. The internet exploded, and it felt like we went from there's nothing on this out there to there's so much information. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. And then you had all these Facebook secret or private groups. I'm not sure I understand the difference, but there were these Facebook groups. But the questions that I saw in the Facebook groups were more or less the same questions. So technology is changing and there's new procedures to be done, but the questions and the emotional journey is the same. So I kind of went into this fog to write. And as you know, probably the same thing for yourself. Just a girlfriend's guide to infertility or a what to expect when you're not expecting type of book that will just won't give you all the medical answers because the medical stuff is changing every day, but will just help you feel a little less alone, maybe get through the process in a faster, easier way. You know, I can't guarantee that someone's going to get pregnant, but that's why I call it the trying game because, you know, I can help you not lose your minds and know what questions to ask your doctors and know how to deal with the people around you just to, you know, help you get through the process in a more sane manner.
Let's talk about the information available on the internet just a little bit more. How can women sift through all of that? And in your opinion, do we really need to be experts in order to be successful?
I'm glad you asked that. When I started, some of the criticism I actually got in the New York Times, because I was just trusting my doctor, and I got criticism on there that said, well, you need to have more information. Why are you going in? And I just thought, well, that's his job. It's not my job. And I think as we go through infertility, and I'm sure you've had this experience yourself, you go in and you trust your doctor because that's his or her job. And she tells you what to do and you do it. But then you realize, oh, wait, there's so much information out there. Maybe I better get on top of this myself and become an educated consumer. So these days, you know, there are some really good resources like Fertility IQ, which reviews doctors and gives kind of like a primer on different subjects. And there's a few other books like my book and then your book that's going to come that will, you don't have to be an expert. My advice to people is to just maybe know, like go in what you're up to. So if you're thinking that you might have fertility trouble or you're not getting pregnant yet, just deal with that. Don't deal with the whole IVF and paying for it. And one step at a time is my best advice. You do trust your doctor and you go on a my doctor knows best plan. But then at a certain point, once you understand some of the lingo and how your body works and what's supposed to happen, you could get more educated. But I think it could get really overwhelming if you want to know the entire course of IVF, IUI. You don't need to know all of it. So I think maybe work on what you're up to. Start off with what might be your problem and don't let it balloon from there, because then you can have what I call, you know, like a kitchen sink panic attack.
So many good points there. As you mentioned, I also trusted my doctor for the vast majority of my journey. And I think if I had been a more active member of my own treatment team earlier, that I would have had success earlier. We are raised to trust doctors as experts, and that's not to say that the doctors we go to aren't experts, but my take on this is we are experts on our own bodies. The doctor has just met us, and we've been living in our bodies for X number of years, fill in the blank there with your age.
Right.
So we do have some inherent knowledge that we should be speaking up about. And the other thing I wanted to say is the one step at a time advice is exactly what I tell all of my infertility coaching clients. Don't think so far ahead. You're going to be completely overwhelmed by that. Live in the present and make decisions that you're dealing with now as opposed to the what ifs down the road.
Kudos to you if you're an expert in your own body. You're more of an expert than a doctor is. But I don't know always if we're experts in our own bodies, and I would like us to be. I would like us to know what our period feels like and if it's painful and what that means. I would like us to be the expert in our own body so that when we go to the doctor, we can present her with the whole picture. And maybe you were. I don't think I was an expert in my own body.
I guess that's a really fair point. That's something that we could take charge of. And the information is available to us. And you're right. I definitely didn't pay attention to things until the end, but I wish I had. And that is another piece of advice that I'd give to listeners. Start paying attention to your body because that information is available to you and you could use it to your advantage.
For sure. Yeah. One of the reasons it's helpful, and I talk about this in the chapter on the 2-week wait, but also earlier on, like what you can do before you go to the doctor, is you should make note of what your PMS feels like and what it feels like when you're getting a period, because that's super helpful to know when you're waiting to find out if you're pregnant. Like even if you're not doing fertility treatment or an IUI or an IVF, if you're in your 2-week wait, all these things online talk about overload of information. Is it PMS or is it your period? No one can tell you what universal signs, but if you know your own body, like if I know about myself that I break out before I'm getting my period. And there were times that I was doing treatment and when I saw a pimple, not to be TMI, but I knew that meant that my period was coming and that the pregnancy didn't work. So I think it's really good to know what your PMS feels like, what your period cycle is like. And these are questions the doctor is going to ask. Are you regular? How often does your period come? How many days does it last? Because these are things that we need to know.
You start your book with, oh, shoot, am I infertile? What should women know when they first start trying, especially if they don't anticipate having problems conceiving?
Well, first of all, we just have to acknowledge the sinking feeling of, oh my God, is this really happening? And I think that happens with any medical situation, whether it's a diagnosis or not. So I think you have to just acknowledge that you've been told your whole life how not to get pregnant. And you thought getting pregnant was going to be super easy, you know, just like 20 minutes and a bottle of wine or something, because that's what we see in the movies. And oh no, it may take a little bit longer and a lot more effort than I thought. And this is for a lot of women, even women, you know, you and I can laugh at a friend that says, oh, it took me 6 months to have my first. But 6 months is, you know, six times of a 2 week wait. And it's still kind of emotionally surprising and draining, even if that person never went through treatment. So I think that one of the things we've all been led to believe is that it's going to be easy. And if you, that first thing you have to just deal with is, okay, it might not be as easy as I thought. And you have to just sit with that feeling. But the other thing that you need to know is, like, don't panic. To quote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, don't panic. It might not be so easy, but this might not be some of the scary 2 year, 3 year, 4 year journeys you read about. Maybe there's a few things that we can do, and let's take it one step at a time between, oh shoot, I'm not pregnant right away, and this is going to be the next 5 years of my life. Let's just see what happens and not panic.
Speaking of things you can do, what do you recommend listeners do before they head to a fertility clinic?
I think that you can find really good gynecologists, and not someone who's going to say, oh, don't worry about it, it will happen, but someone who is going to help advocate for you and do a complete workup. She can test your hormones, tell you before you go to a fertility clinic. She can tell you if your hormones, if your AMH, which measures, you know, could measure your egg quantity and how you would do in treatment. She can measure your hormones, and she should check, evaluate your whole insides to make sure that you have no endometriosis, no fibroids, and nothing that might have been getting in the way of your conception. I can't tell you how many women have been like, oh my God, I've had the most painful period for my whole life, and my gynecologist didn't tell me. And if you have a painful period, you might have endometriosis, and that might just be a treatment, and you never have to go to fertility treatment. You might have a fibroid. I know someone who was told she had a fibroid when she was 30, and they told her it's not a big deal, and it wasn't a big deal. But at 40, she had to get the fibroid removed, and that took her out of trying for, you know, a good 6 months. So this is in terms of what we're talking about, is like, be an advocate for yourself and make sure that your body is completely primed and that there's nothing wrong before you step anywhere near a fertility clinic.
In the book, you talk about a very popular and timely topic today, egg freezing. In your opinion, who should do that?
My opinion is, a lot of the things that we talked about is, I think that every 30-year-old should know where she is reproductively and then make that choice. And I think that even I was like this, and egg freezing wasn't really a viable option when I was 30. But if we're not interested, or we don't know if we want to have kids, we tend to like tune it out because there's so much information going on. I'd love to see every 30-year-old understand where she is on the cycle, like if her cycle is normal, if her egg reserve is normal. And, you know, because if you're 30 and you find out you're going to have problems, maybe it will change your decision than if you find out that everything's fine. I don't want people, and this is what happens, you know, egg freezing is most effective like at 34, and after 37, it becomes kind of questionable in terms of its efficacy if you're going to get good eggs. And what you see now is a lot of women in their late 30s and early 40s freezing their eggs. And I've never met a woman in the waiting room at IVF who wishes, every woman wishes she had younger eggs to work with, because the younger the egg, the better chance you have at pregnancy, because the age of the body is less important than the age of the egg. So I'm saying every woman I've met in IVF wishes they had younger eggs to work with. That being said, I just want people to make educated decisions between age 30 and 34, know where they stand, And, you know, when you do these hormone testing processes and when you do these tests and you learn about your body and how maybe it gets harder to get pregnant when you're older, the decision comes to you. You can say, like, I know someone who's 31 and who said, I know the statistics. I'm not interested right now. Maybe at 34, I'll make a different decision. But that's fine with me because I'm not going to go tell every single person to freeze your eggs. And I'm not going to tell every single person not to. I just want you to have all the information to make that decision.
You have a whole chapter about another really important topic, financing IVF and fertility treatments. What are some creative ways to finance treatments and, of course, other paths to parenthood?
I think one of the popular things is, you know, a GoFundMe campaign or one of those, you know, public financing campaigns. But they're kind of crowded sometimes. So you might want to make a video to find, you know, why this is so important to you. And that's only if you want to be public about it, obviously. The first step is, before you go public, is you should ask your family if your family has means. Some people's parents are said, oh, we were saving this money for your first house. And I know someone who said, okay, thank you for that. That is super generous and kind of you. But can we take that money that you were saving and use it for fertility treatment? We have three sets of parents, my husband's parents, my mom, and my dad and his wife. And we went to them and asked them each to contribute to IVF because they want grandkids. Now, obviously, you know, I'm firmly middle class, and obviously not everybody's parents have money to give them, and not everyone can do that. People are struggling, but there are other ways to finance it. First of all, you need to check if you live in a state that offers IVF. New York just in 2020 just approved IVF for companies over 50 people. So you can find a job at one of those companies. You can also move to a state. So this is tricky, but I know a lot of people who did this. You either move to a state that has financing like New York now or New Jersey or Boston. Boston has excellent benefits. But before you do any big moves, you need to make sure that the company gets benefits. So some companies are insured in states that offer benefits. So even if you live in New York before it had benefits, but your company was based in New Jersey, they might have IVF benefits. So that's a good way to get benefits. And there are companies like Bank of America and Starbucks that offer, I think Starbucks after 40 hours will give you some insurance benefits. So those are great ways to fund your journey. I didn't move jobs. I should have, but I didn't. Another way that you can get it is you can apply for, there's a lot of grants. Baby Quest has a grant. I think there are certain communities, like if you belong to a church or a synagogue, certain religious communities offer fertility financing as well, whether it's a loan or a grant. I'm much more in favor of a grant than a loan. But there are lots of people, if you just look up IVF grants or fertility grants, you can find out how to get one.
You talk about fighting with your husband in the book. What are some tips about how couples can get along while battling infertility?
I fought with my husband, and I had a lot more fights in my head than I had out loud. And in talking to other couples, what I've learned is there's a few different places where people fight. And one of the places is the emotional labor, meaning who's doing what? You know, am I doing all the work? Am I calling all the doctors? Obviously, if it's female factor infertility, then my body is getting most of the stuff done to me. Obviously, and in same-sex couples, I'm talking about the woman who is getting most of the treatment. So we're in lesbian couples, or then it's, you know, two women and probably one is having the most done to her body. So let's say I'm the one who's having most of the stuff done to my body. What is my partner's? Is my partner coming with me to every appointment? Do I want him to come to every appointment, or do I want him to just work? Is my partner doing the research? That's one way that can be more equitable. And it's also good practice for having kids, is to rope in your partner to doing the lion's share of the work. I had one friend who didn't do any research. Her husband did everything, and he would just present it to her and she would do it. Now that takes a certain type of seeding control. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do a lot of the research and I was doing most of the heavy lifting. But at a certain point, I think after my fourth miscarriage, and I just didn't know, I said to Solomon, oh, I've been making all the decisions already. And I think I've made some bad decisions. I think I've chosen a lot of the wrong paths. Here are the two doctors that I'm looking at to help me carry the pregnancy, like reproductive immunologists. We're going to both meet with both of them and you pick, because I can't pick anymore because I made so many wrong decisions. So I think, and he did pick ultimately my doctor who got us our baby. So I think emotional labor, and if you have secondary infertility and there's childcare that has to be done, your partner has to step up there too. So emotional labor is one of the ways that you can fight less. And another way is just the emotional process itself. I think that was our problem. We just deal with things differently. And we would have probably fought about it in other things. But my husband was always saying, keep your eye on the ball. Let's just keep the big picture in mind. And I was sometimes falling apart and needed like a week to recover. And I couldn't go to your family's party and celebrate. I'm just too depressed. I think it's taking a look at couples' emotional style and figuring out how you could, be there for each other. And then one other thing is, and this goes through anything in partnership, is your partner the best person to go through it with? Like, sometimes I talk to women and they say, oh, my partner is annoyed. He doesn't want to talk about it. And of course, you guys should be able to talk about it, but maybe your best friend is the person to go through every up and down with. Maybe your mother is the person that you talk to about everything. Maybe he's not the person. And of course, you can go through therapy. A lot of people do go to therapy, and there are therapists that specialize in infertility. That could also help you. But I think recognizing, are your problems financial, emotional, or like emotional labor? Who's doing the work?
So many great points there. My husband was very supportive. He did all of the shots. He came to all of the appointments. But where we had a disconnect was exactly the same as your situation. He was always so calm and hopeful and didn't even want to talk about it because there was nothing to talk about. In his mind, it was all going to work out. And like you said, such a great description. I was falling apart and I needed someone to support me, not necessarily being unicorns and rainbows all the time, but being realistic with me and having a conversation. I wish I had done all the things that you suggested in terms of like finding someone else who was going to better support me. Not that I don't love my husband, of course, but sometimes you do need somebody else to step into that role.
I'm jealous of you. You know why? My husband was afraid of needles. So he couldn't even do that part.
So well, you want to know what's funny? My husband also afraid of needles. He's the type of person who, when he gets his flu shot, he wears the Band-Aid for like a week until it actually falls off.
Oh my God.
But he has no problems injecting me. I teased him about it all the time. He would actually get nervous at the time we had two cats that required injections. And he would basically pass out at the thought of putting a needle in them. But for some reason, putting a needle in me, no problem.
Interesting. I mean, for that reason, my husband didn't even come with me to the clinic because a lot of time I was just sitting there, drawing vials of blood. And they knew. They were like, leave your husband back there. So in some ways, you're lucky. And obviously, we both love our husbands, but it's about, I have some in that chapter on how to, survive infertility with your husband or your partner. Infertility, there's a rumor or there's a misconception that it will break apart a marriage. And from what I've researched, it will just bring up issues that you're going to have to deal with anyway. And if your marriage breaks up over it, it probably would have broken up anyway. So obviously you and I don't want to have to put our marriage to the test, and it would have been nicer to have, a baby and dealing with it. But it doesn't break up a marriage. But as long as like you recognize who the other partner is and how you deal with things, it can some people it can make stronger, some people it could just bring up the tests earlier.
Hey, infertility warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. You write about regrets. Do you have any regrets? And how can women look forward instead of backward?
Oh, I have so many regrets. Obviously, you know, you started later as well. Not later, you were super young, but you probably think of those 6 years. Oh, what could have happened? I had to speak to someone about this, just how do you, you know, and she's an infertility specialist, a therapist who specializes in fertility. She said, whenever she visits regrets with people, you say, oh, like if I would say to you, Heather, and you say, oh, I should have gotten pregnant at 21, but if I took you back to your 21-year-old self, you didn't want to get pregnant at 21 and you couldn't, you weren't ready, you weren't available. So if you have regrets and you wish you did things differently, if you go back in time, you would probably make the same decision all over again. So with me, not to bring up you, let's say with my situation, when I met my husband at 39 and a half, we like moved in right away and he said, let's just get pregnant. And I thought about it, I really did. And I thought, oh, that would be cool because I come from like a very traditional religious family. And that would be super cool to just show up and be like, oh, I'm married. I'm not married, but I'm pregnant. But I decided against it. I decided we needed to be stronger as a couple before we got pregnant. And then it took another year for us to get engaged and married. So I say, oh, what would have happened if we just would have gotten pregnant? You know, was that the year and a half that I lost my fertility? And it very well could be. It could have been, but then again, if I go back to that situation and what if I would have gotten pregnant and I would have lost two pregnancies with this guy that I only knew for like 4 months, right? We weren't married. And what if I would have lost two pregnancies and he would have just looked at me and said, oh, I'm not hanging out with this woman. You know, our relationship wasn't even strong enough to weather that. So I think regret, we go back in time and we say, oh, I wish I would have done that. But we're also like changing the rest of the facts of the story. You're saying, oh, I wish I would have done it when I was 23. But then you're saying, oh, I wish I was in the right place to get pregnant, but you weren't. So I'm saying, oh, I wish I would have gotten pregnant 3 months in to my relationship with Solomon, but I can't change my body. I still probably would have miscarried anyway, since it wasn't my eggs, it was my body. When we go back and look down memory lane and say all the things that we wish, we have to remember the same situation that we'd probably do the same thing over and over again. Now, the therapist did tell me one interesting point. She said, she talked about future regrets, which is if there are things that you could do now that you know in the future, if you don't do them, you'll regret it, then do it. So for example, if you're 35 and you're rueing the day, you go get your fertility tested and you're so upset because your fertility is not where you thought it was and you're sad about the 4 years beforehand, but oh, you're only 35. If you think that you really want to have a baby and you'll be sad in the future that you didn't do it at 35, then you should definitely do it.
Absolutely. Getting a fertility awareness checkup never hurt anybody, right? That doesn't mean you commit to actually getting pregnant that day. It just gives you information about yourself.
Right, for sure.
And circling back to the regrets, I regret most, I think, transferring two embryos my first transfer. I, of course, would have loved to have actually had Alexis and Eric in my life, but I wonder if I only transferred one, what my life would have been like. However, I have the most amazing four-year-old daughter now, and I know that if we had twins, if that actually worked out, we would have never had her. So your point about going back in time, and you probably would have made the exact same decisions because of what you know now, is so on point.
Right. And how are you supposed to know when you were doing it, they were transferring too? You don't know, by the way, if you transfer. Sometimes a lot of people who transfer two only get one, and sometimes people who transfer one get none. So you don't know if you would have changed that, if you would have gone back in time and changed that, what you would have ended up with.
Absolutely, absolutely. You also talk about baby envy, which I think is probably on every listener's mind this very moment, and the mean thoughts we often have towards others who are pregnant, oftentimes people we know and are perhaps very close to. How can we handle these really intense feelings?
First and foremost, just accept them. These are mean thoughts, and it doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't make you a bad friend. It doesn't make you a bad sister. Someone else, whether it's even this happened to me, the homeless woman on the subway who got on the subway and said, I'm homeless and I'm pregnant. And I commented to my friend and I said, oh, her too? And my friend thought I was so mean, but I couldn't believe that a woman got on the subway was like, I'm homeless, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, oh my God, it's gonna feel like everyone around you is getting pregnant. That's just what it's gonna feel like. And it's okay to feel jealous, to feel sad. And just because you feel sad that they announce their pregnancy and that they're showing their ultrasound pictures and that they're planning their baby shower doesn't make you a bad person. It's just you really, it's not only that you want it so badly, you might have been doing everything in your power to make it happen. And it just feels unfair. It just feels unfair that someone else maybe comes by it so easily. It feels bad to want to be happy for them. But as I said, sometimes like you don't have any happiness in you. So you maybe can't feel happy for them. And it might be just too much for your partner or your friends to expect for you to be happy when you want this so, so badly for yourself. I always say happy in public, voodoo in private. And I don't really mean like voodoo, like you're sitting there taking a voodoo doll in private, but sometimes you have to go to the shower. Sometimes you have to just say, oh, I'm so happy for you. Sometimes you have to say it and then you can just go home in private and cry your heart out. And that's what I did. I mean, my sister and brother were pregnant. My brother's wife was pregnant with his fifth. My sister was pregnant with her first. And I had just had my fourth miscarriage with a donor egg, the thing that they said was 100% going to work. I just couldn't deal. I couldn't. I said to my sister, oh, I'm so happy for you. But then when she started talking about her pregnancy symptoms, I said to myself, okay, I'm not really that happy for you. I was just saying it, you know? Some people can't even say I'm so happy for you. And I have a list of things that I'm sure you'll appreciate, you know, like bless your heart. If you can't say I'm so happy for you, you can say, oh, I'm so excited. You could say, you must be so happy. That's such great news. You have to take care of yourself. Taking care of yourself means that you have to accept that this is where you're at emotionally. I think there's a Buddhist saying that says, don't add suffering to pain. So pain is that you're upset that other people are pregnant, but suffering would be piling on yourself and saying, oh, I'm such a bad person. Why can't I be happy for her? Except that right at this stage of life, you're not the person that's going to be like buying her registry and oohing and aahing over baby socks right now. That's just not where you're at. And I think once you accept that, you know, green, ugly green monster, and you could give it some space, then maybe it will get easier, or maybe you'll be able to fake it better.
How can listeners handle telling people about fertility treatments, and how might they deal with other people's questions?
You have to figure, you know, this is again about knowing yourself, like how are you the type of person that is generally very private, or are you like me who's like a blabbermouth and tells the New York Times everything? If you're a very private person, then you might want to just tell a couple of people, maybe at work and maybe your mother and maybe your sister, and that's it. Or you might want to, you might just want to say in an email or face to face, you might say, listen, we're not getting pregnant and we're starting fertility treatment. And I just want to let you know this because I might not be able to keep my schedule as much as possible. I might have to flake out on plans at the last minute, and I might not be able to do certain things like come to a kid's birthday party. And then you can say, tell them, this is the best way you can help. For some people, the best way you can help is please check in on me to see how I'm doing emotionally. And for other people, the best way you can help is please don't ask me questions about it. I will let you know when I need to know. And even I, who was doing fertility treatment and talking about it in the New York Times, I did not tell anybody when my retrieval day was or when my transfer day was. My husband knew about it, and that was it. When a transfer didn't work, I didn't want 15 people waiting by the phone for the call, am I pregnant or not? So my general mantra was, I'll tell you when there's something that you need to know. And I actually had a few of my friends who are child-free by choice, my gay best friend and my married friends, and both of them in LA, who are my best friends who don't have kids. So they didn't, even if I told them, oh, I had a retrieval today, it's not like they knew, oh, that means in 5 more days, you're going to have a transfer. And then 7 days after that, you're going to get a pregnancy test. The truth is they didn't care because they don't have children and they just wanted me to be happy. So I found them very good outlets to just be depressed about something because they didn't have any skin in the game. And obviously everybody wants what's best for you, but sometimes your friends, maybe with kids, really want it so badly that they get as invested in the pregnancy as you are. And that it's just, sometimes it's hard to like deal with other people's disappointment.
When is your book out and how can people order it?
My book is out April 7th. So it's just in time for National Infertility Week on April 19th. You can order it at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at Target, any place books are sold. And if you know someone struggling, I purposely didn't put it out in hardcover because I wanted it to be also a gift book. So if you know with someone struggling, or if your mother-in-law is being annoying and you want to give her a certain section or chapter, you could buy it for her too. If she has too many questions, you could just say, here's the book, read it, and don't ask me anything else.
I also have to ask about the audiobook version. How did recording that go? I know that I am terrible at reading aloud, and I don't know if that would ever work for me.
Well, you have an amazing voice, so I think you'd be amazing at it. I think the best advice that someone who, a friend of mine who listens to audiobooks all the time, I asked him what makes the difference between a good narrator and a bad narrator. And he said, just picture yourself telling the story. You're not reading a book, you're telling a story. So if you ever get a chance to do your audio, when you know, you can read the whole paragraph and just remember that there's someone who's listening to your story there, then it's not as hard.
Is there anything you'd like to add about the book itself that we haven't already covered?
I think the book has a lot of stuff in it and you could skip around to whatever you're up to, you know, whether it's miscarriage or donor eggs or surrogates. But I think that for anyone on the fertility journey, the best advice that I have for you is to be your own advocate, to take care of yourself. And even though, you know, we both kind of hated our husbands for being so positive, to remember that you're going to have a baby at the end of this journey if you really want. And it might not be the way that you thought you're going to get it, but you can have a family if you want to.
I want to briefly talk about life after infertility. You've had a lot of losses. What do you wish people knew about miscarriage and recurrent miscarriages?
I think that sometimes you hear like a celebrity like Gabrielle Union would say, I had 9 miscarriages. That's not supposed to happen. If your body keeps miscarrying, something's wrong. You don't need to go to a fertility clinic. You could go to a repeat loss specialist. There are plenty who do phone consultations. If you've had more than 2 losses and you know maybe I think any person who has a loss after like 6 or 7 weeks, you should get it chromosomally tested to see if it's normal. And if you've had a couple of losses that are not chromosomally normal, you should go see a specialist because something is going on there.
What is pregnancy and motherhood like after infertility and loss?
I think a lot of this journey is people telling us how we're supposed to feel. I'm sure you can appreciate that. So I think that if you have pregnancy after infertility, and especially after loss, people want you to be happy. Oh, you're pregnant already. You should be so happy. I'm not. I'm really nervous, actually. So, and my doctor said the thing to me was, he said, you're not going to be happy until you're holding that baby in your arms. So forget other people. Forget what they expect of you. Sometimes people don't enjoy pregnancy, whether they've had loss or not. They might have like sickness. They might be throwing up, so they might not enjoy it. So own your journey. It's your own journey. It's not anyone else's. I don't know what motherhood is like after no infertility journey and after no loss. For me, I can say I was checking my baby monitor every 4 seconds. I had it on my phone. And my daughter, finally, she's 4 and a half now. I think she finally threw the camera out of her room. I can't compare it, but I think that maybe motherhood after loss or after infertility, on the one hand, you're so, so, so grateful. And on the other hand, you're also very nervous. But that just might be regular motherhood as well.
I just wanted to add, and I'm sure you'd agree, that it's okay to not be okay during pregnancy and motherhood. I had a terrible pregnancy, but after infertility and loss, like you, I don't know what it's like any other way, but after infertility and loss, my pregnancy was really hard, and I felt guilty for talking about that.
Right. And a lot of people have difficult pregnancies, and a lot of people have, whether you had infertility or not, a lot of people have medical issues. A lot of people have, it's not rosy, and that's okay. It's okay to say, I didn't enjoy being pregnant. I love my baby. Some people say, oh, I didn't even like the first year of motherhood. I have a friend who has 3 kids who says, I didn't like the first year of motherhood, but I like the rest of it.
We always hear about happy endings and persevering, but is there a time when you should call it quits?
I think at every stage, there's an opportunity to say, is this what I still really want? Is this what is working for me? I had that moment after my first 2 miscarriages. I had this moment where I said, okay, I do want to have a baby with my husband, but do I really want to do this? Because I compare it to surfing, you know, in the water, you gotta like, are you going to commit to the wave? I definitely had a few months there where I was thinking about it, like, could I be happy without having children? And I knew the answer was, yes, I could, but this is the path I'm going to choose for myself and my husband. But I think that you can ask, and that's like a 4-part question. Emotionally, are we going to continue down this path? Financially, are we going to continue down this path? Physically, can we continue down this path? You know, is your job, is everything working out? And then are we as a couple good for this path? And there's no shame. I know a lot of people who have stopped and said, no, not for us. Or no, we're changing direction. We're going to adopt. It's not worth it. We don't care about genetics that much. I know, you know, myself, I had to say, am I going to keep trying with my own eggs? And I just never thought I would do donor eggs. But at a certain point, you know, that was at the beginning, I didn't think I would do donor eggs. But at a certain point, I said, I don't want to fill my body with hormones anymore. I don't want to take any more shots. I just don't want to do it. I just want to be pregnant. And that was, some would say that is giving up. Others would say you have your daughter. So I think there is a moment at every part where you can reevaluate if this is the road and if what you're doing is right for yourself.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about life after infertility?
I think for people like us who are thinking about this all the time, even if we have our families, we're mired in it. But for a lot of other people who have done it, they forget about it and they move on and they have, and it's just one chapter in their lives. It's not their whole lives. So I think that even though it seems like everything right now, one day when you're you know, your hair is a mess and your kids are running around and you're wishing you were on a beach vacation. It's all just going to be like a blur.
To wrap up this episode, what words of hope would you offer to a woman who is still on her infertility journey?
I think that you really just should take care of yourself. Taking care of yourself means taking care of your body, knowing what's best for yourself, knowing what's best for your partnership if you have one, and doing what's right for you, no matter what anybody else says.
Amy, thank you so, so much for coming back on the show and telling us all about your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.